Blog Talk Radio.
Bring him.
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Saturday, May 29th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We would like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of our program. Coming up later on, we'll have our Pan-African Newswire report. We'll feature dispatches on the admission by Germany that they had committed genocide in Namibia during the early years of the 20th century. Also, an announcement of a second volcanic operation eruption in the Democratic Republic of Congo is said to have been a false alarm. An Ethiopian analyst says that the United States is supporting terrorism inside the Horn of Africa state. And the interim civilian leaders appointed in Mali after a military coup have been removed from office and arrested. In the second hour, we hear a World Health Organization briefing from Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus discussing developments surrounding the COVID-19 pandemic and the rollout of vaccines globally. Finally, we examine in detail news reports from the African continent and internationally. These and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. So stay tuned, and we'll take a musical interlude with the orchestra Bella Bella from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Let's listen in.
Yes! Kiba Mwana yonga na ligio Ebongio yebisa baboti baeba Walingweza liye loko Mwaya kubatila Sherisa kiba Samba o viki Nave tatolo mobali nanga Nga santi mbamba nana bangate Bache meki koba indangaka Na jure na miso andambe sheri viki Toko kiko boya na te viki Sheri sabiba
We'll be right back. masaba. Oh yeah, masaba. Pepima, yeah, pepima. Angela nini fona linga yo. Fona ima mama poya linga ka. Uko kase mama santima. Oh yeah, santima. Masaba, yeah, masaba.
Never Oh, Eske ahora puerto peso yo pesate. Eske ahora puerto yo peso pesate.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast, and that was the music of the Orchestra Bella Bella with Les Frères Soki from 1974, classic African music from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Right now we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. Our lead story deals with the political situation in the Southern African state of Namibia, which was a former German colony during the late 19th and early 20th century. And news reports emanating from Berlin, Germany, this week says that Germany, for the first time, just on yesterday, May 28th, recognized it had committed genocide in Namibia during its colonial occupation, with Berlin promising financial support worth more than 1 billion euros to aid projects in the African nation. Now, German colonial settlers killed tens of thousands of indigenous Herero and Nama people in the 1904 to 1908 massacres, labeled the first genocide of the 20th century by historians, poisoning relations between Namibia and Germany for years. While Berlin had previously acknowledged that atrocities occurred at the hands of its colonial authorities, they have repeatedly refused to pay direct reparations. According to German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas, he said that we will now officially refer to these events as what they are from today's perspective, genocide. He held the agreement after more than 5 years of negotiations with Namibia over events in the territory held by Berlin from 1884 to 1915. Maas said, in light of the historical and moral responsibility of Germany, we will ask forgiveness from Namibia and the victims' descendants for the atrocities committed. In a gesture to recognize the immense suffering inflicted on the victims, the country will support the reconstruction and development of Namibia via a financial program of 1.1 billion euros, which is about 1.34 billion U.S. dollars, he said. The sum will be paid over 30 years, according to sources close to the negotiations, and must primarily benefit the descendants of the Herero and the Nama. However, he specified that the payment does not open the way to any legal request for compensation. Namibia was called German Southwest Africa during Berlin's 1884 to 1915 rule, and then fell under South Africa's rule for 75 years before finally gaining national independence as a result of the armed struggle of the Namibian people, led by the Southwest Africa People's Organization, SWAPO. Historically, tensions boiled over in 1904 when the Herero, deprived of their livestock and land, rose up against German imperialism. They were followed shortly by the Nama people. This was an insurrection that was crushed by German imperialist troops. At the Battle of Waterberg in August of 1904, around 80,000 Herero, including women and children, fled and were pursued by German troops across what is now known as the Kalahari Desert. Only 15,000 of them survived. German General Lothar von Trotha, sent to put down the rebellion, ordered the peoples exterminated. At least 60,000 Hereros and around 10,000 Namas were killed between 1904 and 1908. Colonial soldiers carried out mass executions. They exiled men, women, and children to the desert, where thousands died of thirst, and established infamous concentration camps such as the one on Shark Island. And you can read this article in its entirety on the Pan-African Newswire. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the government said earlier today that the eruption of a second volcano it had announced hours earlier was, quote, a false alarm, unquote. Fear coming a week after Mount Nyiragongo roared back into life, causing devastation and sparking a mass exodus. The government has said that Marara volcano had a low-intensity eruption on Saturday morning, sending lava flowing into the uninhabited areas of Baringo Park, a wildlife reserve home to a quarter of the world's critically endangered mountain gorillas. Marara is a small volcano considered to be a crater on Mount Nyamu Rwagira, which along with Nyarongongo is known for strong volcanic activity. However, the communication ministry then issued another statement saying, quote, false alarm on Nyarongongo. Quote, a plane has just flown over the entire area on the size of the volcano. No eruption was observed, unquote. It went on to say that there was instead intense activity of carbonizing wood into charcoal, the smoke of which was perceived as volcanic activity. Aerial images of Nyarongongo, taken earlier this morning and viewed by the Agence France-Presse, showed just a few wisps of white smoke in the volcano's crater. Marara rises 25 kilometers north of Goma, the capital of North Kivu province in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. And in the Horn of Africa nation of Ethiopia, an article was published in the Burkina news source, Samuel Ferengi. He says that for 27 years, Ethiopians lived under the brutal regime of the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front, the TPLF, and suffered tremendously under the watchful eyes of the world. Despite the human rights violations and crimes against humanity committed by the TPLF, the United States provided aid in billions and trained TPLF's brutal police and military force. We oppose the U.S. support of the TPLF to no avail. Today, the TPLF is ejected from power, dead as a viable political organization, and engaged in terrorism. Yet the United States is trying to resurrect this terrorist organization by pressuring the Ethiopian government to negotiate with it. Why is the U.S. giving oxygen to a brutal organization responsible for the massacre of millions of Ethiopians now surviving in life support? After 27 years of struggle and enormous sacrifices for their freedom, the people's relentless effort paid a dividend in April of 2018 when the TPLF regime was removed from power and replaced with a reform-minded leader, Dr. Abiy Ahmed. Since then, opposition organizations who lived in exile were allowed to return to the country. The sanctions against political activists and journalists were lifted, and the country began a new path towards a democratic system of government. Since the beginning of the reform, the TPLF was unhappy and made every effort to derail the progress made and return to power. It armed and funded terrorist groups in the Oromia and Benishangul regions, facilitated the massacre of ethnic Amharas. TPLF members who were in the military engineered the killing of civilians. Many Ethiopians were displaced from their homes, and TPLF's propaganda machine claimed, quote, the new Ethiopian leaders are incapable of leading Ethiopia, unquote. Extremist elements joined hands with the TPLF and tried to hijack the change inside the country. Prime Minister Abiy made all efforts to navigate the challenges he faced to lead a stabilized nation. On many occasions, his patience was tested. Instead of resorting to force, he pleaded with the TPLF and those who tried to take power through violence to make them part of the peaceful political process to no avail. Many criticized Abiy for showing enormous patience with the TPLF. Some considered his patience as a sign of weakness. On more than 20 occasions, elders were sent to the TPLF to halt its illegal and provocative actions. The TPLF violated the Constitution and held an illegal election in the Tigray region. Abiy's patience emboldened the TPLF. Instead of being part of the political process, it began beating the war drum to intimidate the federal government. On November 4th of 2020, The TPLF crossed the Red Line and attacked the Ethiopian Defense Forces Northern Command. These soldiers were deployed in Tigray to protect the border from enemy invasion. These soldiers did not guard the border for 20 years before they were attacked. They contributed money to build schools in Tigray, helped farmers during harvest, and also engaged in many aspects of civic activities. Some are married to Tigrayans and have children from their marriages. These soldiers were attacked by the TPLF special forces in their barracks while they were in bed. Thousands have died in a brutal manner. This brutality is condemned neither by the United States or its allies. You can read this article in its entirety and detail over the Pan-African Newswire. And finally, political unrest is continuing in the West African state of Mali. Mali's interim president and prime minister resigned on Wednesday, a top junta aide said, 2 days after they were detained and stripped of their powers in what appeared to amount to the country's second coup in 9 months. In New York, the United Nations Security Council strongly condemned the ouster and arrest of President Ba Ndaw and Prime Minister Mokhtar Wani and called for a return to civilian government, but did not discuss punitive measures. The interim leaders, who had been tasked with steering the return to civilian rule after a coup in August 2020, resigned in the presence of mediators visiting the military base where they were being held, said Baba Sisi special advisor to junta boss Assimi Goïta. However, a member of the Economic Community of West African States, African Union, and the UN mission of MINUSUMSA, a mediation mission, told reporters that the leaders had in fact resigned before they arrived. The delegation then went to speak to Goïta, who holds the rank of vice president in the transitional government again after seeing him late Tuesday. Sisi said the president, prime minister, and other transition leaders arrested on Monday would be released, but this would happen gradually for various security reasons. He gave no timeline. The Security Council, which held an emergency meeting at the request of former colonial power France and others, called for the, quote, safe, immediate, and unconditional release of all the and urged the defense and security forces elements to return to their barracks without delay. Now, although these interim government leaders were released in Mali, the figurehead of the recent coup has been named by the military council as the current head of state. You can read more on these developing stories over the Pan-African Newswire. That's going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment. In concluding this segment, we want to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998, and since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. The episodes can all be shared via email, blogs and websites, and through social media networks. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast, and that, of course, was from Detroit's own Motown sound, Martha and the Vandellas, with the tune entitled Nowhere to Run, Nowhere to Hide. Yeah, and we're here today, Saturday, May 29th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal. And right now we want to move into a briefing from the World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. This is from yesterday, May 28th, 2021. Let's listen in. And, of course, we bring you these briefings from the World Health Organization on a weekly basis, dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, which is still a reality despite the attempts, particularly by the United States government, to, of course, encourage people to resume normal economic activity, meaning in-person work activity, irrespective of some of the contradictions that exist even here in the United States, let alone on a international level. So we're going to be listening again to the World Health Organization.
Hello, good day to wherever you are listening to us today. It is Friday, 28th May 2021, and it's a very special occasion during the World Health Assembly, and it's been a while that we've seen each other. My name is Christian Lindmeier, and I'm welcoming you to today's special press conference to mark the first anniversary of the COVID-19 Technology Access Pool, the CTAP. We have a round of very special guests today, and I'll start with His Excellency Carlos Alvarado Quesada, President of Costa Rica, the Honorable Arantxa Gonzalez Laya, Minister for Foreign Affairs, Spain, Professor Jesus Marco, Vice President of the Spanish National Research Council, CSIC, the Honorable Mariam Kittir, Minister of Development Cooperation of Belgium, the Honorable Budi Gunadi Sadikin, Minister of Health, Indonesia, Abdul Muqtadir, Chairman and Managing Director of Incepta Pharmaceuticals, Alejandra Sanchez Cabezas, the Director for Observatorio de Salud in Argentina. Welcome all. Simultaneous translation is again provided in the 6 official UN languages, Arabic, Chinese, French, English, Spanish, and Russian, plus Portuguese and Hindi. We don't have Portuguese and Hindi today? All right, we have the 6 official languages, but no additional languages today. Apologies. Let me introduce the rest of the participants here in the room. That's first and foremost Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, WHO Director General, Dr. Mike Ryan, Executive Director for WHO's Health Emergencies Program, Dr. Maria van Kerkhove, Technical Lead on COVID-19, Dr. Soumya Swaminathan, Chief Scientist, and Dr. Mariangela Simao, Assistant Director General for Access to Medicines and Health Products. With this, let me hand over to the Director General for the opening remarks. Dr. Tedros.
Thank you. Thank you, Christian. I would like to start by thanking His Excellency President Carlos Alvarado Quesada of Costa Rica for joining us today, and also all other excellencies ministers. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. As you know, this week is the World Health Assembly, the annual meeting of nations to discuss common health challenges and agree a common way forward. The range of issues being discussed is immense, from diabetes to malaria, disabilities, oral health, and much, much more. And of course, COVID-19 has been the focus of a lot of discussion. There has been broad consensus this week that equitable access to vaccines is essential for ending the COVID-19 pandemic. With over 3.5 million recorded deaths from COVID-19, an estimated loss of the global economy of $22 trillion, and new variants compounding explosive outbreaks, this pandemic is far from over. At the World Health Assembly this week, there has been broad consensus that ensuring equitable access to vaccines is essential for ending the COVID-19 pandemic. In my opening remarks on Monday, I called on world leaders to support a massive push to vaccinate at least 10% of the population of every country by September and 30% by the end of this year. Our sprint to September goal means we must vaccinate at least 250 million more people in low and middle income countries, including all health workers and the most at-risk groups at the first priority. If countries immediately share doses with COVAX and if manufacturers prioritize COVAX, we can reach this target and save a lot of lives. Ultimately, the fastest way to bring this pandemic to an end is to dramatically increase global manufacturing of vaccines, tests, treatments, and other medical supplies and ensure equitable access. A year ago, the President of Costa Rica, His Excellency Carlos Alvarado Quesada, and more than 40 heads of state joined WHO to form CTAP, the COVID-19 Technology Access Pool. CTAP draws on the experience of the Medicines Patent Pool and provides a single platform where innovators of COVID-19 health products can voluntarily share knowledge and technologies with quality-assured manufacturers. CTAP is based on a proven method: voluntary, non-exclusive licenses issued through the Medicines Patent Pool have saved lives by scaling up manufacturing for treatments against HIV, TB, and other diseases. We welcome the interest expressed by several diagnostic manufacturers who are already in advanced discussions with CTAP to share their technology, and also from research institutions who are willing to share their knowledge through CTAP. But we need more developers to come forward and share life-saving tools so that we can ramp up production and expand access. Originator companies that contribute their knowledge to CTAP can quickly access the production capacity they need to manufacture enough for everyone while collecting appropriate royalties. Contributions to CTAP are voluntary, transparent, and non-exclusive, allowing multiple qualified producers around the world to manufacture COVID-19 health products. Once agreements are signed, CTAP will support companies in the management of signed agreements for effective implementation and provide technical assistance to countries where needed. Once fully functional, CTAP assisting in the expansion of manufacturing could provide increased supply for countries and COVAX. Today, I'm honored to be joined by the thought leader behind CTAP, His Excellency Carlos Alvarado Quesada, President of Costa Rica. The President and I issued an open letter yesterday calling on all countries to support CTAP. Governments can play a lead role in creating incentives for industry to support our effort. Your Excellency, thank you for your leadership and welcome, and you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros, and thank you for your leadership and also your team's leadership, not only a medical leadership, but a moral leadership that we need at this time against COVID-19. And also, thanks to all the ministers and national authorities that join us today. Costa Rica is proud to celebrate the first anniversary of the Solidarity Call to Action and its platform, the COVID Technology Access Pool, known as CTAP. I want to recognize the engagement and collaboration of 42 states that have jointly supported CTAP, and welcome Spain and the newest co-sponsor. I also want to thank Dr. Tedros again and the WHO team for their continued leadership and partnership. The CTAP was launched with the conviction of its potential to help the world to stop the pandemic, seeking for multilateral solutions to accelerate the development of the therapeutic tools needed to fight COVID-19 and to guarantee global access for diagnosis, therapeutics, and prevention, including vaccines. All of this by promoting innovation, removing barriers and facilitating open exchange of knowledge, intellectual property, and data on a voluntary basis. Making this knowledge available through non-exclusive licenses and in a transparent manner can help release bottlenecks and scale up production not only for vaccines, but for medicines and treatments, allowing production in different parts of the world. We have always known that only when everyone, everywhere, can have timely access to the health technologies for COVID-19 detection, prevention, treatment, and response, we will be able to fully recover from the pandemic. And CTAP can help us achieve that exactly. The shocking inequalities on the access to vaccines demand a change of practice. It is not acceptable that more than 50% of the globally available vaccines were used in only 5 countries that account for 50% of global GDP. Shamefully, low-income countries have received only 0.3 of the world doses. This week, together with leaders from the Latin American and Caribbean region, we made an urgent call to those countries that have excess doses or that have already vaccinated their population at risk to share those surpluses in an immediately and equitable way. But that is only one piece of the puzzle. We must also overcome the challenges generated by bilateral negotiations and property rights. For this reason, today we will also like to invite all of those who have not yet joined the CTAP to do so. Costa Rica will continue supporting a stronger architecture on pandemic preparedness and response, including a WHO treaty on the topic. We hope that the principles of CTAP will be a central part of a future action. The COVID-19 has imposed upon the world an enormous challenges, not only social, but economic. We have lost millions of lives, millions of jobs and opportunities and smiles. We have understood how vulnerable we are, but the crisis has also given us a chance to make things differently and work together in ways we had never done before. And hopefully, we will be able to overcome it in solidarity, cooperation, and strengthening the international pandemic response framework. Once again, thank you very much. Un saludo, mi amigo y mi hermano.
A greeting to my friend and my brother, Dr. Tedros.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Hermano. Thank you, Your Excellency. Thank you so much for your leadership and for those great, great comments. I couldn't agree more that in this moment of acute need, we must utilize all solutions to boost manufacturing capacity. And the only way is cooperation. The only option is cooperation. And I like the way you said it. We lost millions of lives, millions of jobs, millions of smiles. It has affected the whole world. So thank you so much. Muchas gracias, hermano, for your leadership. Next, it gives me great pleasure to welcome the Honorable Arancha Gonzalez Laya, Spain's Minister for Foreign Affairs for the European Union and Cooperation. Arancha, my sister, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Tedros, it's a pleasure to join you and the President of Costa Rica in this important moment. If we are to defeat COVID, we need to exponentially increase the production of vaccines and ensure much faster distribution to those in need around the world. This is why we launched an initiative called Vaccines for All. We think we need to exploit fully all the flexibilities that exist within the rules of intellectual property worldwide. We think we need to increase exponentially the manufacturing by using unutilized capacity and transferring know-how and technology to produce. Three, we need to ensure faster distribution to all corners of the world. And fourth and final, we should be capitalizing COVAX and sharing vaccines, especially those that have availability today. This is our vision for ensuring equitable access to vaccines, and because we like to preach with the example, we are here today to tell you that we have just decided to join CTAP, to join this initiative that will ensure the transfer of knowledge, technology, and know-how to speed up the production of vaccines. We are proud to join the family that Costa Rica and others started building last year. Non-exclusive, transparent licenses are vital to increase production, and we do hope that by boosting CTAP in the next in the coming months and transferring know-how and knowledge, complemented by all the flexibilities that exist within the rules of intellectual property rights, we can enable production worldwide, especially in developing countries. There, where production capacity today is a possibility but not a reality. We have always favored measures to facilitate universal access to medicines and treatments. We've done so, for instance, through our support to Unitaid, also through our support to the medicine patent pool. We are now glad to see that the medicine patent pool and CTAP are working together. We are contributing substantively to CTAP, and this is where I'm very glad that the Vice President of the Spanish National Research Council, Jesus Marco, will also take part and explain the modalities for our engagement in CTAP. Finally, we think we must ensure greater synergies between CTAP-ACTA, the initiative of which we are also a founding member and an active contributor. If we do so, we will have all the ingredients to win the battle against COVID. So thank you again for giving us this opportunity.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Arantxa. Thank you. By joining CTAP this month, Spain has made a very important statement to the world about the need to enhance vaccine equity. I now turn to your compatriot, Professor Jesus Marco, Vice President of the Spanish National Research Council. Professor Marco, you have the floor.
Thank you. Buenas tardes.
Good evening.
At CSIC, the Spanish National Research Council, we have worked since the beginning of this pandemic to ensure that all the COVID-19 related technologies being developed in our labs reach society as soon as possible. Our aim is for them to be manufactured in Spain, but also in any other country that demands them. And to this end, we have approached these licenses for the assignment of exploitation rights for these CSIC technologies on non-exclusive terms, avoiding situations in which demand cannot be met due to the production limitations on the part of the licensee. In this regard, and being aware of the CTAP initiative, a few months ago we began talks with both the WHO and the MPP with the idea of launching transfer projects in which an open license would be granted for the commercialization of CSIC technologies. Specifically, the first approach we have considered is based on the development of a serological test with 99% reliability, capable of identifying and quantifying three different types of antibodies, IgG, IgM, and IgA, and also able to differentiate antibodies produced by vaccination from those produced by natural COVID-19 infection. In addition, as part of our global vaccine project, CSIC is also committed to promote the commercialization of some of our vaccine candidates, studying the possibility of licensing them on a non-exclusive basis in order to meet society's demand, and help on building capacities and transferring the technologies to low and middle-income countries. Thank you very much. Muchas gracias.
Thank you. Muchas gracias, Professor. You're right that publicly funded research plays a key role in the development of health technologies, and in the midst of a pandemic, now is the moment to share them fairly. Next, we're joined by the Honorable Mariam Kitia, the Minister of Development Cooperation of Belgium. Minister Kitia, the floor is yours.
Mr. President, Mr. Director General, ladies and gentlemen, the past year we faced many issues of conscience as human beings. As office holders, we had to take up responsibility. Never have we mobilized so many resources in so little time. And I do not have to tell you, our safety and freedom depend on our willingness and capacity to provide that same safety and freedom to everyone around the world. No one is safe until everyone is safe. But there is a reality we cannot deny. Let us not forget we are in a pandemic for more than 1 year now. An unprecedented crisis requires unprecedented responses beyond business as usual. Solutions exist, but still are unused. A few countries have secured the majority of life-saving vaccines, much more than needed, and left billions of people behind. While the pandemic is not over and health systems continue to collapse. While according to UNICEF, only 43% of the world production capacity for approved vaccines is used. Ladies and gentlemen, we succeeded in developing vaccines at an unusual speed, but we failed to share life-saving COVID-19-related technology and knowledge and to speed up their production. So it is crystal clear. Our challenge is to provide more doses as soon as possible at an affordable price to be administrated everywhere. And 1 year ago, the Belgian government signed the Solidarity Call for Action. We did so because we were convinced that the only way forward was by joining forces, government, organizations, and industry together, with a clear public health object in mind, by putting self-interest aside while facing a common enemy. And today, we are still convinced, more than ever. So as Minister of Development Cooperation, I take a strong commitment to further promote CTAP at national and international levels. And if we want to boost production capacity, knowledge and data need to be shared. And I will also continue to urge pharmaceutical companies and other stakeholders to consider CTAP at voluntary sharing of knowledge as an acceptable and viable solution. In Belgium, we recently organized a roundtable with public, private, and academic actors bringing together expertise, know-how, and technology. And with Team Europe, we are keen to support local manufacturing capacity of medical supplies and vaccines in Africa. So ladies and gentlemen, the first anniversary of the CTAP is a key moment. A key moment to develop a new business as usual. A key moment to show joint leadership. A key moment to prove once again that we are stronger together. Because the most effective vaccine in order to defeat this pandemic is not only what is in the syringe. No, the most effective vaccine is called solidarity. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Minister Kitia. Belgium has a key role to play to ensure that everything possible is happening in the EU and across the world for the equitable production and rollout of tests, treatments, and vaccines. So thank you so much for your commitment and leadership. Next, I'm pleased to introduce the Honorable, my friend, Budi Gunadi Sadikin, the Minister of Health of Indonesia. Minister Gunadi Sadikin, please, you have the floor.
Mr. President, my brother Tedros, ladies and gentlemen, COVID-19 pandemic has brought us to one of the darkest times in recent history. Indonesia by today has 1.8 million confirmed cases and around 50,000 deaths. While we have seen good news in some part of the world, in many countries rolling out successful vaccination program, diagnostic and therapeutics, some of other countries are still lacking at accessing of those tools. As one of the first countries to join CTEP, Indonesia strongly supports CTEP initiative to ensure global access to vaccines, diagnostics, and therapeutics technology in our fight against COVID. Indonesia is ready to contribute. As the largest vaccine manufacturer in Southeast Asia, we indeed have the capacity to upscale our vaccine productions to meet regional and global demand. We have a unique position also because we are one of the largest Muslim countries where manufacturing vaccine with a halal certificate sometimes can be very crucial in the implementations of a vaccination program. Currently, we have six manufacturers with production capacity of 550 million doses per annum. Unfortunately, we can only produce vaccine with the technology platform of virus or protein base. We don't have access to vaccine with factor base or nucleic acid base like messenger RNA. So we are really looking to have access to those technologies, and we are ready to contribute. I totally agree with my brother Tedros that always say that no one is safe until everyone is safe. Let me add, if a country want to go fast, they can go alone. But if countries want to go far and long, we have to go together. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, my brother. By the way, I would like to say this is actually a rare occasion, and it's not often actually, we're joined by a nuclear physicist. the first time actually. So thank you so much. I'm just telling the audience your background also. And you write that in Southeast Asia, some countries are under enormous pressure, and we appreciate your readiness to contribute to scale up production of health products. Our next speaker is Abdul Muqtadir, the Chairman and Managing Director of Incepta Pharmaceuticals from Bangladesh. Mr. Abdul Muqtadir, the floor is yours.
Thank you, sir, for inviting a company from Bangladesh. CTEP is a wonderful initiative, and we congratulate the President of Costa Rica and Director General of WHO for establishment of this platform. Many people have released very soothing and encouraging statements about Syria, but unfortunately some of them are misleading and empty. 1 year has passed, but the initiative is yet to bring any result. We have seen some summary statements like low and middle income countries do not have the ability to acquire the technology and deliver quality products. We wonder who made this critical assessment and how people can make such statements. Contrary to such comments, 80 to 90% of the medicines by volume for the whole world, including the developed countries, are made by such generic companies. If some people are not willing to collaborate, then it is their choice, and the world leaders should try to find out the real reason and mitigate their concern. Only through such initiative, these companies can be brought to CTEP. Let us be all clear in our mind. that there are untapped high-quality production capabilities in countries like ours, and these can be utilized to increase the supply of vaccine. In going forward with such initiative, all stakeholders will benefit more than not doing so. We should try to find out ways to make CTEP successful. Let us identify what technology is actually available. Inactivated vaccine appears to be providing good efficacy, and the technology is well known. WHO may take the following steps to make it available. Clearly document the technology and arrange sharing of clinical data from existing manufacturers. Number two, if the existing producers are not willing to share data, then WHO can define a clear regulatory pathway for first generation of data through comparative clinical studies with approved vaccines. Number three, provide information on availability of equipment and other relevant information on supply chain. There is another one important thing, that international collaboration is often hindered because of national regulatory authority of some countries with substantial vaccine manufacturing capacity do not have WHO approval to their NRA, that is, do not have functional NRA like ours in Bangladesh. We urge to WHO leadership to urgently look into the situation and arrange expedited approval of NRA of vaccine producing countries from lower and middle income countries. This step will certainly provide a major positive change in availability of vaccines. In addition, protein subunit vaccines are showing good potential and the technology is widely known. A successful vaccine may be selected by WHO and clear regulatory pathway may be defined. It can be manufactured fast in billions of doses and can be offered at a very, very low cost, and we can do it. No one is safe until everyone is safe, like you say. But we are not doing enough to keep everyone protected, especially in resource-poor and unprivileged countries. There is no time to delay. Every single day matters. CTEP is a timely initiative that provides a platform for hope. And let us make it successful. Thank you, sir, for giving us the platform to speak out.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Muqtadir. It's concerning that vaccine manufacturing capacity is not being used in many countries, and as you said, including Bangladesh. This is the moment when all capacity should be fully utilized, and I hope technology and know-how are pooled soon so that Incepta can start making life-saving doses. Now, last but by no means least, I'm pleased to welcome Alejandra Sanchez Cabezas, the Health Observatory of Argentina. Ms. Sanchez, you have the floor.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, dear Director General. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. It is a great honor for me to be able to represent the civil society organizations as well as the scientific world to express our concern regarding the lack of access to citizens around the world to medical products, especially vaccines. I come from Latin America, the most inequitable region in the world, and here the pandemic has only widened the gap of inequality. There has been a lack of vaccines, which has forced governments to decree very strict lockdowns that have slowed down the economy and have worsened the situation. Now, civil society organizations as well as the scientific organizations that I represent believe the following. One, that member states and the World Health Organization have taken decades to recognize the importance of health as a human right. And it is necessary to take action on the social determinants for health and work towards universal health coverage with models of solidarity that are based on primary health care. Now has come the time to translate into action these tools, ensuring equitable and universal access to vaccines as well as to medical products that are necessary to deal with this pandemic. Universal health coverage means today universal access to vaccines. Two, unequal access to vaccines is not only an issue of patents and privileges. One can only read the headlines to observe this unequal access to vaccines and medical products. We see this in the news all the time, and in the news we also see scenes of violence and wars and desperate waves of migrants. And on these same news pages, because of the pandemic, we can see the threats of new governments looming as well as the weakening of democracies that seemed so securely established. Three, the American continent has an experience on the role of vaccines and the strengthening of peace and democracy. In fact, the initiative Health as a Bridge for Peace that the regional officer for the WHO, PAHO, and PAHO, launched in the 1980s and 90s, has shown that we can convene civil society, the state, and the market that can provide conditions that improve the lives of their people. Four, civil society is a responsible stakeholder alongside states and multilateral agencies and work on initiatives such as SETUP, ACT Accelerator, and the COVAX facility. The most powerful in the world must understand that there is no future possible if only technological access and technological medical products are only in the hands of a few. This needs to be a collective interest and must be shared amongst all. We need to have urgent action to be able to reverse the trend that we see in Latin America and in other LDCs. Less developed countries have to be able to deal with emergencies without depending on philanthropic organizations that provide funds that are insufficient but that provide them too late as well. We need international organizations, governments, and pharmaceutical companies. We need them to rise to this historic challenge. Civil society aspires to live in a world that is more equitable and more democratic. We are here to support those that want to harness the real necessary power to mobilize inclusive and supportive activities. Civil society is ready, and it is now time for action. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Sanchez. And I understand that Argentina is going through a serious COVID-19 wave at the moment, and I agree with you that now is the moment where we pull out all the stops and do everything we can. Thank you again to all the speakers. As you have seen today, CTAP is backed by a significant number of country leaders, researchers, and companies from around the world. Civil society organizations have also supported CTAP strongly, and I thank them for that. We're holding the door open for pharmaceutical companies that have become household names, although too few households have benefited from the life-saving tools they have developed. They control the IP that can save lives today, end this pandemic soon, and prevent future epidemics from spiraling out of control and undermining health, economies, and national security. The major gap is originator companies, but I believe that with the right political will and the right incentives, we can see an increase in collaboration and pooling that would help end this pandemic. I thank you. And Christian, back to you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tedros. Thank you very much, all. With this, let me now open the floor to questions from the media. And if you want to raise your hand, please use the raise your hand icon on your screen. And when it's time, don't forget to unmute yourself. The first on my list is Agnes Pedrero from AFP. Agnes, please unmute yourself.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you for taking my question, which is on the COVID origin study. This week, there have been a growing calls from experts, but also from countries like US and European countries, asking WHO to launch quickly the second phase of the study. But there seems to be little progress on that matter, and we have been told this morning that the WHO technical experts haven't made their recommendation so far. So given the importance of knowing the origin of the COVID for now, but also for the other pandemics, when do you expect to have those recommendations ready from the technical committee? And when we can expect to see a new deployment of experts in countries and maybe on China or other countries? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Agnes. And we'll hand this to Dr. Mike Ryan.
Yeah, it was rather difficult to understand your question, but I will attempt, and Maria can help me along on this. We continue to work with the international team in looking at their recommendations from the first mission. We've engaged with member states since then, with a large number of member states, to seek their inputs into the next phase of the studies that are needed. And I think this is important to restate that WHO nor our member states, when they made the resolution last May, WHA 73.1 specifically referred to studies and missions, because it was clear that it was going to take time and it was going to take multiple studies and likely multiple missions in order to fully elucidate the origins of the virus, if that were ever possible, given the difficulty historically with being able to do that. We will be reaching out to member states in the way we normally would in order to seek their guidance as to whether there is further expertise available that could join with this international effort, especially in the next phase, where more specialist studies may be needed in order to further elucidate the origins of the virus. We would, though, like for everyone out there to separate, if they can, the politics of this issue from the science. This whole process is being poisoned by politics. And if you expect scientists to do their work, if you expect scientists to collaborate and actually get the answers that you want, actually seek in a non-blame environment to find the origin of the virus so we may all learn how to prevent this happening in future, we would ask that this be done in a depoliticized environment where science and health is the objective of this, and not blame and politics, because quite frankly, over the last number of days, we've seen more and more and more discourse in the media with terribly little actual news or evidence or new material, and this is quite disturbing, quite frankly. Every country and every entity is free to pursue their own particular theories of origin. It's a free world. WHO is a member state organization, and we seek to work with all of our member states to seek answers collectively. We do that within the framework of the mandate that we have as an organization. We do that in collaboration by consensus. That is the way our organization works. The Director General has been clear. All hypotheses for the origin of the virus remain on the table. Further studies are going to be needed across the board to further elucidate those origins. And we believe we can make more progress, especially with the support of our member states and the support of scientists working in a positive manner. To do that, we need space. To do that, we need governments to work together and create the space in which this work can be done successfully. Putting WHO in a position like it has been put in is very unfair to the science we're trying to carry out. And it puts us as an organization, frankly, in an impossible position to deliver the answers that the world wants. So we would ask that we separate the science from the politics and let us get on with finding the answers that we need in a proper, positive atmosphere where we can find the science to drive the solutions through a process that's driven by solidarity, as Dr. Tedros always says. Maria?
Very briefly to add, I wholeheartedly agree with Mike's answer there, and to really separate the science from the politics. So there are some quite clear recommendations that have been outlined in the detailed report that the international team published in March. Many countries are digesting that and reading that in quite some detail. They're really devouring it in that sense to kind of pull out all of the relevant information in there. If you haven't read that report, if you haven't read all of the appendices, I really ask you to do so because there is a wealth of knowledge that is in there. And it clearly outlines the technical approach that is needed. As Mike has said, as we have said many times, this requires many studies. It requires multiple missions. It requires collaboration, openness, time. And so those technical next steps are very clear. As Mike has said, we have also been discussing with some member states who are offering some support and offering some input into what they think are also needed. It's very much in line with what is reported in the report itself, so that is good. So we will continue to do so and outline those next steps, and as soon as possible is really the answer, that we want to continue to do this work. But I do think we need to manage the expectations. It will take time. And it's hard enough to do as it is, so with the politics involved in it, that makes it even that much harder. So let the scientists be the scientists. Let us sort of stay rooted in the evidence and follow that evidence and continue to carry out those studies.
Thank you very much, both. With this, the next question goes to Ana Pinto from Folha de Sao Paulo. Ana, please unmute yourself.
Hi, thank you. I have a question to Dr. Mariangela Simão. And I'm so sorry I cannot ask in Portuguese today, but anyway, let's go. Let's go in English. Dr. Simon, I'd like to know, I wonder if you have any expectation about authorization for the coronavirus vaccine. If I'm not wrong, it was expected for the end of this month. And if you have not, I'd like to know what's lacking in this process. Thank you very much.
Dr. Simão, please.
Sorry, I can't speak in Portuguese either today. Thank you, Anna. We are finalizing the assessment of CoronaVac as the Sinovac vaccine. Right? There was need for further clarifications on the data that was provided. The responses have arrived this week, and on Tuesday next week, we will have our technical advisory group, which is the expert group who advises WHO on the listing, on the authorization. So we expect that Tuesday we will have a decision, and the report should be available the next day for sure. So it's next week, and it was just a delay because there were some clarifications needed from the manufacturer.
Thank you very much. Next question goes to Simon Ateba from Today News Africa. Simon, please unmute yourself.
Thank you for taking my question. This is Simon Ateba with Today News Africa in Washington, D.C. And thank you for doing this longest press briefing series for more than a year now. Yesterday, the WHO Africa Department said Africa needs at least 20 million doses of AstraZeneca vaccine in the next 6 weeks to get second doses to all those who receive a first dose within the 8 to 12 week interval as recommended by the WHO. We know that President Biden is sending 80 million doses to COVAX by the end of June, beginning of July, and that the EU member states have pledged to share 100 million doses with COVAX. I was just wondering if you could detail how pressing is the vaccination situation in Africa, and how many of those doses would you like to see go to African nations? Or even, what is the WHO doing now to ensure that Africa is not left behind and that those who need a second dose have it? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll guess maybe we start with Dr. Bruce Aylward, who joined us, who is, of course, the Special Advisor to the Director General, the lead on the ACT Accelerator. Bruce, go ahead.
Thank you very much, Simon, for the important question about what's happening with respect to the vaccine rollout in Africa. As Simon referred to yesterday, the regional director for Africa held an urgent press conference to highlight the issue that Simon's referring to, and that is the fact that Africa has vaccines sufficient for less than 1% of the population of the continent, striking disparity when you look at the situation in any other region of the world, in fact. So indeed, Simon, this is one of the areas of greatest attention, greatest urgency, and hence the reason for that press conference yesterday. Simon, they did refer to the need for 20 million doses to serve as second doses to the AstraZeneca doses already given, but the regional director went further, and she emphasized that we need 200 million doses, and that is sufficient doses for nearly 100 million people on the continent to stay on track with the goal of getting at least 10% of that population vaccinated on the subcontinent by the end of September, en route to at least 30% by the end of this year, as is the goal right now, just through COVAX alone. That's not even counting doses that would come through other arrangements, such as that being made by the African Union. So there is indeed a huge amount of work ongoing with countries that have doses. I don't want to say surplus doses, but that do have doses and have already vaccinated their high-risk populations, their healthcare workers, and are in a position, we believe, to begin sharing doses. doses with areas such as Africa in particular and most urgently. So I can assure you, Simon, that is one of the top priorities and not the top priority in terms of additional doses. But at the same time, you will have seen the situation in Southeast Asia where we've had escalating outbreaks in countries surrounding India in particular with a desperate need for their second doses as well. So the need is indeed on the continent, but also in various parts other parts of the world as well. In terms of donations, indeed, we're in close contact with the United States, with the European Union member states and other countries about now trying to move as quickly as possible on the commitments and of donations that they've made. And you'll remember we talked about this last week. We're going to need the support not just of the countries that are donating the vaccines, but also the companies who actually they have contracts with, because that's a really important part of the solution. And we were pleased to see over the last couple of weeks some strong commitments from manufacturing associations and manufacturers to try and do everything possible to ensure that donations can be actioned within days of countries that want to share them. And then the third part of the equation, of course, is working with COVAX, and then, of course, with the countries receiving the doses to make sure that they go to use as rapidly as possible. So a huge priority, Simon, trying to get those doses in place. We need many more doses than 20 million. That's just to get the second doses into the very, very few people who have been vaccinated so far. We need hundreds of millions of doses to start moving toward vaccine equity and to start getting not just the high-income, well-vaccinated areas out of this pandemic, but the entire world, because as the Director General said so many times, we can't get out of this alone. We need to get out of this together.
Thank you so much, Dr. Aylward. And for Dr. Swaminathan, please.
Just to add to what Dr. Aylward said, it's true that we are doing everything possible, and we encourage all countries that have excess doses to share with us, to share with COVAX facility as soon as possible so that we can get those out and vaccinate people who need to be protected. It's just to say that, you know, we're learning more and more about how these vaccines can be used, the gap between the first and second doses. There are studies going on that are looking at mix and match, and these are encouraging findings. So to reassure people that even if the second dose is a few days or weeks later, it's still going to serve as a booster, and it's still going to boost that immune response and give high levels of protection. So while we should do everything possible to stick to the guidelines, which currently is 8 to 12 weeks gap for the AstraZeneca vaccine, but there is emerging evidence that a second dose will boost, even if the gap is a little bit longer. And in fact, one dose boosts immunity in people who've had a previous COVID infection. So a single dose in people who've been previously infected is as good as getting two doses of the vaccine. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Dr. Swaminathan. The next question goes to Priti Patnaik from Geneva Healthwise. Priti, please unmute yourself.
Hi, good evening. Thank you for taking my question. We understand that CEPI has mapped manufacturing capacities in the developing world. Will this information be shared with CTAP? And how many, if any, companies have expressed interest in working with CTAP? Thank you so much.
Dr. Swaminathan, please.
I can start, and Dr. Simao will definitely follow up. So yes, we have this manufacturing task force now within COVAX, so that's CEPI, WHO, Gavi, and UNICEF, plus other partners, including the private sector, that have come on board. And the idea really is to try to solve the acute problems of supply chain and raw materials and fill and finish. And CEPI, in fact, has fill and finish capacity that they have already booked. So any companies that need excess fill and finish capacity that have bulk product can be immediately matched. In terms of the mapping, yes, there is an extensive mapping going on, and there's also work going on to have one place to bring together all the different initiatives that are happening, because as you know, there's a lot of interest in this space and many different countries and groups are looking at how to expand manufacturing. So it's important to bring all those initiatives and be aware of and collaborate. The manufacturing capacity work should be completed soon and it should be made available for sure, because the idea really is to encourage developers and those who have the know-how to link up with places where there's capacity. We heard the head of Incepta from Bangladesh making a very impassioned plea for using capacity in companies such as his and many others that exist across the world, including in Indonesia. We had the Minister of Health also speak about this. So there is capacity, there's interest, and there's willingness of both from companies and governments to really invest in this and ramp up production. So this is really a call for those who have the know-how and the capacity to come and collaborate with us, with the manufacturing task force, and through CTAP, we can really enable and assist this to happen in a very well coordinated and equitable manner. Mary Angela.
Thank you, Preeti. Thank you, Dr. Soumya. We are in discussions and some advanced negotiations with five diagnostic manufacturers, and we have in sight two vaccine producers that would be willing to share technology, and the discussions are initiating right now through CTAP. And just to remind everyone that when we are talking about CTAP, we're talking about a platform that's an open sharing, with the, including the licensing, but also the open sharing of knowledge that will include technology transfer. And we do have, and we heard that from Incept as well, we're asking WGO, because there are a lot of manufacturers in the developing world who have quality assured products, true pre-qualified products, WHO pre-qualified products. So we are talking about a huge capacity out there, and there is a lot of interest in receiving technologies. So we do have five manufacturers from research institutions that produce diagnostics who are in advanced conversations with CTAP, and we expect that other companies will come as we are. This is not to. I think this is the time to understand the urgency of this conversation, right? Because we, more than ever, we are discussing during the World Health Assembly, we are discussing a local production resolution that has received massive support from different countries. More than 100 countries have supported it so far, and it's likely to be approved in the next few days. So there is this mandate from the WHO, the World Health Assembly. There's an interest from countries, and there should be an interest from manufacturers as well, as we are seeing interest from academic institutions, like we heard today from Spain. Thank you.
Thank you very much, all, and it's very good that with this last question we came around again to our topic of today, this COVID-19 technology access pool, CTAP. So thank you all for your participation. I'll look at His Excellency Carlos Alvarado Quesada, President of Costa Rica, in case he's still available for final comments. Doesn't appear to be the case, in which case I will start handing back to Dr. Tedros, of course, for the final round. But before that, let me all remind you that we will be sending the sound files and the audio files of this briefing right after the press briefing, and we'll have everything online as of tomorrow morning. For any further questions, please write to mediainquiries@who.int. Dr. Tedros, over to you.
Thank you, Christian. And I would like to thank President His Excellency Carlos Alvarado Quesada for joining us today and for his leadership, and also to all ministers who have joined today and other colleagues representing different institutions, various institutions. And I would also like to use this opportunity to thank the media for joining us today, and bon weekend, and see you in our upcoming presser next week. Bon weekend.
Welcome back, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, worldwide radio broadcast for the early morning hours of Sunday, May 30th, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to another edition of our program. And that was a World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, led briefing from Friday, May 28th, from Geneva, Switzerland, discussing the status of the COVID-19 pandemic as well as other public health concerns internationally, along with the problems and prospects of the vaccination rollout related to the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment for today. Welcome back, and that was the voice of Betty Wright with her tune entitled Pure Love. And we do have nothing but pure love for you here at the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. And we're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and we're here every week bringing you some of the most advanced and developed information from the entire African world and the international community in general. If you'd like to have access to this program to share with other potential listeners, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. Right now we want to move into a segment of Africa Live from CGTN. Let's listen in.
This is CGTN, China Global Television Network.
Mali's military leader is appointed as the new president of the country's transitional government. Displaced families in the DRC city of Goma in dire need of humanitarian assistance. New laws to force public agencies to allocate funds to tackle threats in Uganda. Hello and welcome to Africa Live. As always, great to have you with us. I'm Richard Ntah live in Nairobi. And for those of you joining us from across the continent and around the globe, we thank you for joining us. Let's take a look at other stories making headlines this hour. Coming up in business, Zimbabwe suspends grain imports over a projected bumper harvest. And in sports, home favorites Rwanda Patriots sail through to the last four of the Basketball Africa League. Once again, welcome to Africa Live. So good to have you with us. We begin in Mali, where the Constitutional Court has announced military leader Assimi Goïta as the president of the country's transitional government. This followed the resignation of interim president Ba Ndao and Prime Minister Mokhtar Ouani on Wednesday following their release from detention. They were arrested on Monday hours after naming a new cabinet, which saw two army officers replaced. The UN Security Council said the abdications of the interim leaders were forced and demanded an immediate resumption of the civilian-led transition. Colonel Goïta led a military coup last year and has held the position of vice president since then. Several hundred Malians have rallied in the capital Bamako to support the army. This is after the military reasserted control in the state by appointing coup leader Assimi Goïta as the new interim president. This counts as the second takeover by the army in less than a year since August, when former president Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta was deposed. West African leaders are set to meet in Ghana on Sunday to consult on how they will respond to the latest move by the Malian army.
Today, I came to the Independence Boulevard for two things. Firstly, I have come to support my army. Secondly, I have come to tell the international community that the problem in Mali today is a Malian problem. A Malian problem is solved between Malians, so the solution is between Malians and not elsewhere. So we ask the international community to let the Malians manage this problem among themselves.
In our country, unfortunately, all classes are divided, whether it is civil society, the political class, or the youth. The only body that is united is the army. For the survival of our country, this last rampart, which is the army, must remain united. Our contribution in this sense is to call them to be united and to support them, to report our unwavering support, to show the national and international community that we support our army. We support our president, the unflappable patriot Assimi Goïta, and we support all the directives that he will take for an honorable exit in the crisis that we are undergoing today.
In the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, residents rushed to leave the city of Goma, fearing another volcanic eruption by Mount Nyiragongo. Tens of thousands have already fled to neighboring regions and across the border to Rwanda. Others have decided to stay in Goma after lava flows from last week's eruption halted on the outskirts of the city. Both groups are in dire need of humanitarian assistance.
Too tired to hit the road again. That's what some Congolese in eastern part of the country say. This is despite authorities warning of a new eruption.
The situation in Goma is bad. Everyone has fled. There's not many people who have stayed. They have fled the Nyiragongo volcano following the governor's message, which asked the people to evacuate. and they were obliged to flee because of their fear of the volcano. The reason I am still here is because I had to evacuate my family who are currently suffering in Sake. Their legs are swollen. The reason I've come back to Goma is because I have not found a place for them.
For many others, though, they have joined the second wave of people pouring over the Rwanda border. They know all too well the terror an eruption can bring.
It's not a good situation. We are all afraid. The traffic isn't like what it was in the past, like it is normally. There's just a dedicated group of us left here, those with duties to do, such as security guards.
An estimated 3,000 people are said to have arrived at a camp in Rwanda. The influx has the UN Refugee Agency and Rwandan government worried about an outbreak of coronavirus and inadequate supplies. More people are expected to cross into Rwanda in the coming days.
We already need urgent global support to keep monitoring, knowing what is going on. And we are already seeing also signs on our part, like this city at the border adjacent to Goma, Rubavu, Gisenyi. Already homes have been destroyed by earthquakes, the roads, the infrastructure.
The Rugero camp where the fleeing Congolese will be staying is roughly 10 kilometers from the border with DRC. Some of those fleeing this potential disaster have been taken to another smaller camp some 28 kilometers from the border. Authorities say those who want to go back to DRC can leave. Chomwono, CGTN.
Humanitarian organizations have stepped in to try and offer assistance to the hundreds of thousands of people fleeing their homes. We spoke to Nia Murugan. She is the country director for the Norwegian Refugee Council. Let's take a listen.
It's estimated that 80,000 families have left Goma to either Rwanda towards Sake or Bukavu. So the families that aren't welcomed into their extended family homes or to families that they know definitely need to have urgent assistance, particularly around water and sanitation. So we've already heard that there may be some cases of cholera in Sake where there are displaced people since last weekend because of the eruption of the volcano. So definitely the most urgent needs are water and sanitation, followed afterwards by shelter. And then I think that also one of the key pieces is information, but people definitely need more information about where the risks are to enable them to take informed decisions, because already some people are going back to Goma because the earth tremors have reduced, and so they feel that it's safer to go back, but we don't yet have expert opinion on whether that's the case. So here we already have vast numbers of people in need across the country, and a huge number of people who are food insecure. It's estimated to be 27 million this year, not be taking sufficient calorific intake every day. So already the needs are enormous, and to have then an additional burden of, up to between 300 and 500,000 people who are in urgent need of assistance and uncertain of when they can return home will just definitely make it more complicated to address the needs of other people. And that's complicated further by the fact that many of the humanitarian organizations working in Eastern DRC have bases in Goma. And so their humanitarian staff, who are normally engaged in providing assistance to displacement affected communities, are actually now displaced themselves. And so the delivery of assistance will be far more complicated in the areas where response is already ongoing.
French President Emmanuel Macron has thrown his support behind South Africa's battle at the World Trade Organization for a waiver that could see African states manufacture their own COVID-19 vaccine. Macron has been in South Africa for a state visit. He held talks with his South African counterpart, President Cyril Ramaphosa, on a number of issues that include the COVID-19 pandemic and trade relations between the two countries. CGTN's Yulisa Njamela has more.
This is the first visit by the French President Emmanuel Macron to South Africa, and it's at a personal invitation by President Cyril Ramaphosa.
The two leaders' agenda was packed. They discussed deepening of bilateral relations between the two nations, economic recovery and ways of achieving peace and security on the African continent. South Africa is France's largest trading partner in Africa, while France is South Africa's second largest trading partner in the European Union.
This has been a wonderful visit, which also solidifies a good friendship that has evolved between myself and President Macron. We generally see things more or less in the same way and are quite supportive on a number of areas and a number of issues. So we will continue working together. And for our two countries, this forms a very solid foundation to continue strengthening the relations between South Africa and France.
The bilateral meeting was mostly engaged with the issues pertaining to the COVID-19 pandemic. The two leaders spoke about the global COVID-19 response recovery plan during the meeting.
It is on the COVID-19 that we are feeling France's keen support and solidarity in that they are prepared to take the lead, to advocate Africa's case. And let me say that, yes, France is seen as a friend of Africa, and President Macron fits into that role so well and so easily, because he'd like, yes, the entire continent to succeed, and we want to promote good relations with France on an ongoing basis.
The French president vowed that his country will provide millions of COVID-19 vaccine doses to help African countries speed up their inoculation drives. He also pledged that France will help South Africa and other African countries to develop capacity to produce their own vaccines to fight the pandemic.
We want to build a strong partnership in order to speed up the giving of doses and technology transfer that will enable us to set up production capacity in South Africa and Africa and fight challenges to issues of intellectual property, which should certainly not slow down things.
The presidents also discussed the violent retaliation by insurgents in northern Mozambique, where French energy giant Total withdrew its operations following deadly attacks which affected both South African and French nationals. Macron said that France was willing to support diplomatic interventions if Mozambique requested it.
France stands ready to help, but at the request of the state, the government, the regional institutions, and the African Union. This is what we will do in this conflict, and we'll be working on the issues of Mozambique, and we will very much contribute to building a space of security and stability.
The two heads of state also paid a visit to the Vaccine Production Support Initiative for Africa at the University of Pretoria. Yolisa Njamela for CGTN in Pretoria, South Africa.
And in other news, 32 members of parliament have died from COVID-19 since the start of the pandemic in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that's around 5% of the total number of MPs. The lawmakers have been reported to have violated imposed regulations. They have frequently gone without wearing masks as they congregated in large groups. Many Congolese are also reluctant to take the vaccine because of fears of adverse effects and because the virus appears to have had relatively little impact on the wider community. As a result, around 75% of the 1.7 million doses of the DRC to the DRC received in March were reallocated the following month to other countries to make sure they were used before they expired.
This pandemic is everywhere, killing thousands of people, increasing the death rate around the world. In DRC, the latest update announced by the government reports 31,248 confirmed cases and 780 deaths, among them 32 members of parliament.
The World Health Organization says Africa needs at least 20 million doses of the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine, and soon. The jabs would inoculate those waiting to receive a second dose within the 8 to 12 week interval after the first dose. CGTN's Daniela Arap-Moy reports.
The World Health Organization has called for a massive vaccination push in Africa. The call comes as cases of COVID-19 continue to rise across the continent. According to the World Health Body, 28 million COVID-19 doses of different vaccines have been administered in Africa so far.
At a minimum, Africa needs at least 20 million AstraZeneca vaccines by mid-July to deliver second doses to everyone who received their first shots. Africa needs vaccines now. Any pause in our vaccination campaigns will lead to lost lives and lost hope.
Another 200 million doses are needed for Africa to vaccinate at least 10% of its population by September this year.
As WHO, we are appealing to countries that have already vaccinated their high-risk groups to significantly expand and bring forward their pledges and actions to share doses. Dose sharing is an urgent, critical, and short-term solution to ensuring that Africans at greatest risk from COVID-19 get gold standard protection.
France has already shared COVID-19 vaccines from its domestic supply, donating over 31,000 doses to Mauritania. But as supplies dry up in Africa, dose sharing is becoming more critical in fighting the spread of COVID-19. The World Health Body is currently helping African member states to lay the groundwork to build up vaccine manufacturing capacity. Daniel Arap Moi, CGTN, Nairobi, Kenya.
Namibia has introduced new anti-COVID-19 policies for travelers coming into the country. Visitors coming from or transiting through hotspot regions such as India are required to repeat a PCR test 7 days after arrival. This means antigen rapid diagnostic test results will no longer be accepted for entry into Namibia.
Patients who have contracted COVID-19, they need to be hospitalized. Earlier on, about more than 80% of the cases, they did not need hospitalization and they did not display any symptoms. But currently, we are progressively seeing patients who comes and need to be hospitalized and they need to be put on oxygen. So the oxygen supply have become a bit of a challenge because the infrastructure which we had before was sufficient for our normal ICU cases. But with the addition of more COVID-19 patients, we have to expand the infrastructure for sufficient oxygen supply. But it still remains a challenge. We have detected the variants which are found in UK. We have also identified variants which are found in South Africa. We do have about few cases of people who came from India and they are positive. Now, we cannot say that the variant which is found in India is widespread in Namibia. That information we do not have. So far, we have vaccinated more than 60,000, more than 60,000 people who took the first dose, and then a considerable number of them who have already taken the second dose.
You're watching Africa Live. We'll see you on the other side of the break with more news stories. Don't go away.
I think as humans we sometimes forget that we come from water, that it's not a foreign space. We spend our first 9 months in water. We're born from water into light, sound, colour, breath. As we become forgetful of water, we lose a connection to the planet and to ourselves and to each other. We are a species of a blue planet, of an ocean planet. It should never have been called planet Earth. It should always have been called planet ocean.
Welcome back to Africa Live. Thanks for staying with us. I'm Richard and Tom. U.S. President Joe Biden has released his first budget proposal worth $6 trillion. If approved by Congress, it would be the largest in U.S. history. The budget includes huge increases in social programs and infrastructure. Our White House correspondent Nathan King reports.
It's a big budget, $6 trillion of spending, essentially focusing on raising up the welfare of the American middle class, but also, of course, the infrastructure bill that would not only fix roads and bridges, but also pave the way for a greener economy. It's a very ambitious spending bill, and of course, this is just a blueprint. It has to go through Congress and would raise U.S. debt levels not seen since the Second World War, about 117% of GDP, and also raise the deficit for the next decade, but according to the projections, would actually phase out the deficit because of the economic growth it provides. Every president says it. But the big question is whether it can get through Congress. What the president is doing here is slightly hedging. He's put a lot of what's already in the infrastructure bill, the American Jobs Plan, into this as well, just in case he doesn't get it through the Senate. They can get it through with 51 votes under a process called budget reconciliation. We'll have to wait and see, but it's very ambitious. Negotiations will take a long time with the Republicans, but this president is using the emergence from COVID and this idea to leveling up the American people and bring together the wage gap by taxing corporations.
Now's the time to build the foundation that we've laid, to make bold investments in our families, in our communities, in our nation. We know from history that these kinds of investments raise both the floor and the ceiling of the economy for everybody.
Now, a lot of Republicans don't like this idea. It's going to be hard fought, but you could say it's one of the most ambitious budgets that we have seen from the White House in decades. Nathan King, CGTN, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin has met with Belarus's President Alexander Lukashenko in a show of support. Belarus is facing mounting criticism from Western leaders for intercepting a passenger jet and arresting an opposition activist on board. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
The presidents of Russia and Belarus met for the first time since Sunday's incident involving a Ryanair passenger jet that was forced to land in Minsk. Vladimir Putin extended a warm welcome and an invitation for a swim at his summer's residence in Sochi to Alexander Lukashenko in a sign of Moscow's support of its closest neighbor and ally in Europe. After referring to what he called an outburst of emotions over the incident, Putin pointed to the positive trends instead between the two countries. They're strengthening economic ties, nuclear energy cooperation, and growing bilateral trade. Russia remains the biggest trade partner for Belarus, which is facing new sanctions from its second largest trading partner, the European Union. The EU leaders threatened to hit core sectors of the Belarus economy, such as exports of oil and fertilizers, as well as to freeze credit lines to the country's banks over the forced grounding of the passenger plane and the arrest of an opposition journalist on board. Many European nations have imposed flight bans on Belarusian airlines and ordered their national carriers to avoid the country's airspace. Lukashenko said the West is seeking to stir a new arrest in his country, referring to mass protests that erupted over the disputed results of last year's presidential elections.
There is an attempt underway to rock the boat to reach the level of last August.
The Bolivian president's plane was once forced to land. The president was taken off the plane and was okay. Everyone kept silent.
He mentioned he brought a briefcase of confidential documents that he would demonstrate to Vladimir Putin so that he could see what was really going on in and around Belarus. International Civil Aviation Organization has launched a probe into the plane intercept. Daria Bondarchuk, CGTN, Moscow.
Friday marked World Hunger Day. Each year, the world celebrates the achievements and sustainable solutions to end hunger. This year, however, more people are at risk of experiencing chronic hunger than ever before, in large part due to COVID-19. And that's according to reports by humanitarian organizations. since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic. An estimated 119 to 124 million people have been pushed into poverty. Aid agencies are calling for immediate and collective efforts to help end hunger. We take a look at Nigeria, where many families are now engaging in small-scale farming to feed themselves and be self-reliant. Correspondent Tessa Makende reports from Jos.
49-year-old Umaru Ige is a retired banker in Jos. Now he owns this farm where he cultivates vegetables and cereals and also rears rabbits.
Hunger is actually biting very, very seriously in Nigeria. And we have all the resources that is required to be able to attend to that food security. This is one of the things that inspired me to really go into farming, so that I can contribute my quota, and so from it I have been feeding my family for the past 3 years.
8.6 million people are food insecure in Nigeria's northeast alone, according to the United Nations World Food Programme. Umaru Ige is just one of many Nigerians farming to combat hunger.
It will become more necessary and much more profitable for every person to engage in small-scale farming, like even from the garden where you can plant all your vegetables, like your cabbages and carrots and some other things, you know, that will help to boost your and add value to whatever you need.
There are calls for the government to support small-scale farmers so the hunger situation can be addressed better.
It would be very good if government and even spirited individuals who maybe have more resources can support such little ventures by even creating little communities where they farm together and fundings have been made available for them, and even a very small kind of aid as subsidizing with fertilizers and probably other organic manures and other things that can help these small-scale individuals.
The Nigerian government says it is acting. The government this year provided support to small-scale farmers in 7 states in the country in partnership with the International Fund for Agricultural Development. More than 8,000 of them received packages comprising of climate-resilient seeds high in nutritional value. They are designed to help farmers achieve good production and secure their incomes. The hope is that this will allow farmers like Umaru Ige to contribute to tackling the hunger crisis in the country. Tessem Akende, CGTN Jos, Nigeria.
Uganda is taking significant steps towards dealing with climate change with its new laws requiring public agencies to allocate part of their budgets to tackle the problem. The National Climate Change Bill is the first of its kind in the country and aims to create a more unified response to deal with the growing threat, as Leon Sinyange reports.
According to climate change advocates, Uganda has consistently struggled in the implementation and enforcement of climate-related policies due to lack of a legal framework. The new bill will enable the implementation of better climate change response measures and also provide for a coordinated national approach. The bill, passed by Uganda's parliament in April, is the country's first on climate change.
In our local context, we must make our laws depending on our level of capabilities and also level of socioeconomic development. And that's what we did. So we believe that this bill will help Uganda really to address climate change.
Uganda has previously ratified major climate change agreements like the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the Kyoto Protocol, and the Paris Agreement. However, financing climate change measures remains a major challenge. In the new bill, various government ministries will be required to allocate part of their budgets to climate change-related programs.
Along that line, we believe we can generate climate change financing that can help to address climate change, not only at the center, but also the percentage goes to the local government. After all, we have to address these climate change issues at the local government level.
Environmental campaigners say the bill will greatly enhance the already existing efforts.
For the moment, we can be able to trace action from the different duty bearers, first within government, parliament for so much time could not touch on anything. Parliament, in their allocation role of resources, national resources, have been always expected to allocate resources for climate-specific action and programs within government, but there was no framework within which that could happen.
Uganda continues to experience significant impacts of climate change, landslides in the east, prolonged drought in the north, and devastating floods in the western part of the country have been common in recent years. It is estimated that the risks are likely to increase in the future. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni is scheduled to sign the bill in the coming days. It is expected that once a law, it will promote a better pathway and support towards mitigating and adapting to climate change, a major threat to the country's national development goals. Leon Sanyange, CGPN, Kampala, Uganda.
We have our business segment coming up next. Here's a look at what's ahead. Zimbabwe suspends grain imports over a projected bumper harvest. And Uganda Airlines adds Johannesburg to its growing list of destinations around the world.
It's new, it's different, it's a challenge.
It's really exciting.
Over the last 14 hours of rain.
Welcome back to Africa Live. We appreciate your company. The Nigerian Naira has weakened on the parallel market after the central bank devalued the official exchange rate by 7.6%. The Apex Bank has replaced the exchange rate with a managed float figure used for investors and exporters. The local unit sold for 495 Naira per dollar on the street on Thursday from 486 on Monday, according to a website that collects and combines parallel rates in Lagos. The Naira opened at 411.08 on the investors and exporters window, otherwise called NAFEX. On Tuesday, Central Bank Governor Godwin Emiefiele confirmed that the bank is no longer dealing in the official rate of 379, but instead has adopted the NAFEX for government transactions. Although some investors are concerned about the gap between the investors' rate and the parallel market, the central bank governor says the government will keep monitoring and intervening in the market to keep the value of the local currency within a range that it deems fit. State-owned Uganda Airlines is set to start direct flights to Johannesburg, South Africa. The first flight of the four times weekly flights from Entebbe to Johannesburg is scheduled for May the 31st. The Johannesburg flight will enhance connectivity to and from the carrier's current network, which includes Kenya, Tanzania, the Democratic Republic of Congo, South Sudan, Somalia, and Burundi. Apart from its Africa expansion move, the carrier received two long-haul aircraft targeting the European, Middle East, and Asian markets this year. A projected number of harvests has seen Zimbabwe suspend grain imports to preserve scarce foreign currency and stabilize local food prices. As Ryan Walker to your report, Zimbabwe's maize harvest will be nearly 200% higher than last year and 130% above average.
Successive droughts saw Zimbabwe rely on maize imports to supplement low harvests and feed millions of citizens at risk of starvation. However, one of the best rainy seasons recorded in two decades, promises to deliver about 2.7 million tons of grain, more than enough for domestic consumption, which has prompted the ban on imports.
In the past 18 months, we imported close to 1 million tons. And 1 million tons, at the current import parity price, that's slightly above $300 million. So we're going to save $300 million. But more importantly, we have created jobs. We have re-energized the main industry, the primary industry, which is, of course, farming, the jobs there, and the other supporting industries. Those are into farm machinery, you know, fertilizers, inputs. So we have internalized that $300 million.
While there's a maize surplus, aid agencies such as the World Food Program warn that some urban dwellers, particularly those who've been adversely affected by the COVID-19 restrictions, may still require aid because the cost of some basic foodstuffs remains out of their reach. There's unlikely to be an immediate drop in the price of the staple maize meal because GMO imports were cheaper than the locally grown organic maize.
Yes, the our local maize might be cheaper than, might be perhaps slightly more than what we've been importing, because what we're importing at that critical time is lower quality maize. However, we anticipate that price will initially stabilize and then start to deflate and come down, because supply is up. There's so much maize meal in the maize in many households, so demand for commercial maize meal in the first half from now or in the next 6 months is going to be very low. And when demand is low, supply is high, natural supplies will come down.
Millers plan to offset the subdued human requirements through stock feed production, where they project a surge in demand that signals increased production across all major livestock categories, an additional boon for the rebounding agriculture sector. Farai Mwakutuya, CGTN, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Tourism in South Africa is still feeling the pain of COVID-19 and the subsequent lockdowns in 2020. According to the latest industry statistics, foreign arrivals to South Africa dropped 71% from almost 16 million in 2019 to just 5 million last year. CGTN's Sumitra Naidu takes a look.
Pre-COVID, the tourism sector accounted for approximately 709,000 jobs. Income from accommodation grew by over 2% in 2019, despite a decline in international tourists. But today, hotels in particular are struggling to stay open.
In February, we were 72% down. The hotel industry was struggling the most. It was very interesting. If you look at January and February, the hotel industry's average rate, which I think then was about 800 or 900 rand, the guest houses were actually at a higher average rate, which is unusual. It's usually hotels that cost you more than a guest house. That's switched around again.
Business-wise, we haven't just lost from an accommodation side. We've also lost from conferencing and events where we used to host meetings, events. We don't really do that anymore. People have learned to have their virtual meetings, their Skyping and Zooming.
According to Stats SA, income from accommodation decreased by 66.8% year-on-year in November 2020. The largest decline in income was reported by hotels, down 69.6%.
It hasn't been doing very well, obviously because of borders being closed. Most of our clientele is international, so we've lost a lot of business. A lot of hotels around Sandton have actually closed as well since the start of lockdown. Most of them haven't opened. So we've been very lucky that we've stayed open right through, but our business has dropped a lot, and we're catering mostly now for domestic travel compared to our international travel that we used to.
Hotels have had to scale back on
Welcome back, and that was a report from Africa Live, CGTN, for May 29th, Saturday, and that's going to bring to a close Pan-African Journal episode for today. And we have been here during the late hours of Saturday, May 29th, and the early morning hours of Sunday, May 30th, 2021. We've been broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and we'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in to another edition of our program. And if you'd like to have access to the program, just go to our website at the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And we have over 1,000 episodes in our archives of the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast. If you want to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off. We'll be signing off with the jazz guitarist Grant Green from 1959. Have a beautiful week. Mm-hmm.